kind of wealth. Now let's look at landed property, and I read you from Isaiah now. Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you live alone in the land. The Lord Almighty has declared in my hearing, surely the great houses will become desolate, the fine mansions left without occupants. A 10-acre vineyard will produce only a bath of wine, a homer of seed, an ephah of grain. I've forgotten what the measurements mean, but you can get the general drift of it. Micah. I haven't just selected these. The Bible, the prophets are full of it. And it's applicable to their economic circumstances. The prophetic writings aren't stuck up in a cloud, applying equally to everyone because they apply to nobody. The prophet had something to say about Melbourne 1990, you know, Sydney. They're talking about their world. And when we know about their world, we can see why they said it. We have to find it. Reflections that stir us to think about our world. Well, in his world, Micah's world, which is the 6th, 7th century Jerusalem, the same place as Isaiah, same time. Woe to those who plan iniquity, to those who plot evil on their beds. At morning's light they carry it out because it is in their power to do it. He's talking about judges here. Those who have the... In the early morning was when they had the court held at the gates of the city because that's where the space was. And before the day started, they'd get up in the morning. Psalms are full of this. Rising in the morning to do evil. Doesn't mean getting out of your bed and going around and trying to pinch somebody's pyjamas off their line down the road. It means early morning is the time for the court. So it's acting unjustly. Buying, selling, putting down, declaring, widow, orphan, etc. At morning's light they carry it out because it's in their power to do it. They've got control of the judicial system. They covet fields and they seize them and houses and take them. They defraud a man of his home and a fellow man of his inheritance. His land. Therefore the Lord says, I am planning disaster against this people from which you cannot save yourselves. You'll no longer walk proudly, for it will be a time of calamity. In that day men will ridicule you. They'll taunt you with this mournful song. We are utterly ruined. My people's possession is divided up. Back to Amos. It didn't leave much to be for the imagination. Not only wealth, not only landed wealth, but here he has a go at luxurious palaces. Proclaim to the fortresses of Ashdod, the Philistine area, and to the fortresses of Egypt. Fortress was the place not only for military strength, but it was where they kept all their wealth, huh? Banks, the whole business. Assemble, he's shocked at what's going on in Samaria. They've just built this beautiful city and they're making Samaria just look like Ashdod or just look like Egypt. They're vying to be like the great rich capitals of the world. That's what they want. And he's stunned that this would happen in among people who were actually slaves, liberated from Egypt, and brought there to belong to each other, to care for the poor, to be the poor of Yahweh. And here are these people carrying on the same value system as the enemy, as it were. He says, come you lot, come here, look at Samaria. Can you believe it? See the great unrest within her and the oppression among her people. Oppressed among Israelites who are the oppressed who've been redeemed. It's crazy. But here it is, happening in our midst, he says. They don't know how to do right, declares the Lord. They who hoard plunder and loot in their fortresses. Therefore, this is what the Lord Yahweh says. An enemy will overrun the land and pull down your strongholds, plunder your fortresses. Prophet Habakkuk. Woe to him who builds his realm by unjust gain, to set his nest on high, to escape the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the walls cry out, and the beams of the woodwork echo it. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and establishes a town with crime. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbours, pouring it from the wineskin till they are drunk, so that he can gaze on their naked bodies. Jeremiah chapter 22, verse 13 and following. Woe to him who builds his palace by unrighteousness, his upper rooms by injustice. We only need one room, but we've got an upper one. Talking about their world, eh? We've got our equivalent, but the luxury element is built on by injustice, making his countrymen work for nothing, not paying them for their labour. He says, I will build myself a great palace with spacious upper rooms. So he makes large windows in it, panels it with cedar, decorates it in red. Does it make you a king to have more and more cedar? Did not your father have food and drink? He did what was right and just, so all went well with him. He defended the cause of the poor. He, by the way, is Josiah. This is Jeremiah's time. He's speaking against Manasseh. Oh no, sorry, Jeconiah, son of Josiah. Why don't you do what your father did? He defended the cause of the poor and needy, and all went well with him. Is that not what it means to know me? There's a key line, please underline it. Jeremiah 22, whatever it is, about 16. When he's talking about justice, this key line bursts out. Is not that what it means to know me? We don't know Yahweh if we don't know that Yahweh is the one who cares for the poor and oppressed. I don't know him. I'm praying to God, what's a name? But I don't know Yahweh if I don't know this, because Yahweh is the one who hears the cry of the poor, and if I'm not hearing the cry of the poor, I'm not listening to Yahweh, nor am I where Yahweh is. That's not he who says to me, Lord, Lord, who enters the kingdom, but the one who does the will of my Father. I was hungry, he gave me to eat. I was thirsty, he gave me to drink. It's all here, but anyhow. Is not that what it means to know me? But your eyes and your heart are set only on dishonest gain, on shedding innocent blood and on oppression and extortion. Therefore, this is what the Lord says about Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. They will not mourn for him. They will not mourn for him. Alas, my brother. Alas, my sister. They will not mourn for him. Alas, my master. Alas, his splendor. He'll have the burial of a donkey, dragged away and thrown outside the gates of Jerusalem. He was the king at the time of the collapse of the city. And now a section on political injustice. Injustice at the level of politics. And this is all fairly primitive material. It all applies to their economic and political system quite appropriately. We have to see how it applies to ours, don't we? It hasn't got the answers for us, but it's got the movement and direction and critique that we have to apply. I'm reading now from the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 17, verse 16. Deuteronomy, written at the same time as Jeremiah, effectively, began to be written then, and then it takes a few generations to find the form we have it, but it belongs to this same world of the Jerusalem of the late 7th century BC. The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, for the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. You're not to build your economic system on the system of the pharaohs. Come out from it, says the author of the Apocalypse. Don't live that way. For the Lord has told you, you're not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he's to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law, taken from that of the priests who are Levites. The king, the political leader, has to live according to the law. So getting his own personal scroll and read it and live by it. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees, and not consider himself better than his brothers and turn from the law to the right or left. Kind of politicians we want, if any of you dare and have the courage and grace to move into that field, are people who care for the polis care for the whole people and have the intelligence and the imagination to create and carry out law that will be according to Christ. Hard to do. You'll never quite succeed. Well, who knows whether you will or not. We'll only succeed if we all work at it. But that might be your burden and your ministry. Then he and his descendants will reign a long time over the kingdom of Israel. From Micah chapter 6, verse 9 and the following. Micah writing at the same time as Isaiah. Hear this, you leaders of the house of Jacob, you rulers of the house of Israel, you who despise justice and distort all that is right, who build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with wickedness. Her leaders judge for a bribe, her priests teach for a price, her prophets tell fortunes for money. Yet they lean upon the Lord and say, is not the Lord among us? No disaster will come to us. Therefore, because of you, the political, judicial, and religious leaders of the people, because of you, Zion will be ploughed like a field, Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble, and the temple hill a mound overgrown with thickets. That's all I chose to do with you at this particular occasion. There are many, many more I could have done, but when you go back and read the prophets, it's not an ethereal message talking about spiritual poverty or spiritual wealth or some kind of vague, ephemeral feeling nice inside when we're kind of under a tree praying. Let's not knock any of that. It's about real people, real world, real economics, real houses, real values, real decisions, and it's tough. And the prophets are right in there where the tough part is. The real oppressions are felt. And so was Jesus. He didn't live in a monastic silence of saying and finding himself in some special kind of umbilical prayer and therefore wafting above the poor. He chose to be there, which is the Christian journey. There is a place for contemplative life, of course. No, I'm not denying that. It's a mysterious place and a rare place, but there is a place for it. But it's got to be at the heart of the world. It's got to be relevant to the real world. We're not allowed to escape into irrelevancies anywhere. We're called, like Jesus, to be there, eating with the sinner, drinking with the sinner, caring for each other, and taking whatever steps we each can, depending on where we are, steps of love. And you don't love me, as James says beautifully, if I come in and I've got no clothes on and I'm naked and hungry and you say, God bless you, praise God, isn't it wonderful, I love you, and then go on about our work. We each of us have to care for everybody else insofar as we're poor. You have to care for me in my poverty, where I need love perhaps, where I need whatever it might be I need, whatever love really means for me. And if love really means for me a feed, give me a feed. And if love means for me a home, give me a home. You mightn't be able to, but let's try. If love means for me lowering the rent, you lower the rent. I don't know how you do it, but all together we've got to, what else is there to do? We've got to create a network, economic, political and social network where people's dignity can be respected and loved. And I used to sometimes think, well, I've lived at Douglas Park for a while and we've just built up there, I know, I won't make it too personal, but, you know, they've built this terrific freeway, you know, there's freeways all over the world, and freeway, there was enough beautiful stone there to build 1,000 homes. We as a society have chosen to put billions of dollars, for example, into building freeways so that we can get faster from one place to another. If you knocked on the window of most cars and said, why are you getting there faster? We wouldn't know. They wouldn't know. And we ourselves probably wish it would take us a bit longer, because even if we could just have a rest. So I'm not sure that speed has gained much, but let me leave all that aside, because it's too big for me to talk about. What I had this little dream one day, I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if as a society, and this is the idyllic, stupid thing, this has to be nailed down by people who know something about it, I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if everyone on their wedding day was given a home by society as a gift? So just getting married, here's a home. They do it in Papua New Guinea. They do it in most places in Africa. They do it in most simple societies. They gather around, they've got their home the next day. We have two young people struggling to get to know, man trying to find out what woman is. She attracts him, but she hasn't got a clue what she is. He doesn't know what she is. And when he kind of marries her, all you blokes who are married, I'm sure you'll agree with me. I've, what I've heard 100 times during the ruddy, what do you call that place you go, honeymoon period, they get so many shocks. And about 6 months later, they think, you know, this banshee that they're married to, who's got all these emotions that they can't cope with. And she's married to this boring person who's more interested in the times than in her, or whatever it goes on. Male, female stuff. They've got all this stuff to cope with. Living together. And it's wonderful, but it's hard. Now what have they got to cope with? They've got to cope with both having to work. They can't have a family. They can't get together. They've got blah, blah, blah. And for 30 years they're in the hock or something. Now I just thought, wouldn't it be good? I think I'd rather scrap all the freeways and put all those millions of dollars into giving everybody as a gift on their marriage day a home. Stupid. Anyone who knows anything about economics could shoot me down. I know, and I'm not using that as a good idea, for crying out loud. I'm just saying, somewhere in there, we all have to see what is important and what is the values we're really working on. What do I need? What do you need? What do we need? And let us, from our understanding of God, everyone says, I know where you should start. You remember Abbé Pierre? You might have heard of Abbé Pierre at the end of the Second World War, a French priest who was France was in a mess after the war, as was in every other country. And he gathered together a group of people. He called them, I think, the Disciples of Emmaus. It was what he called little houses. And he has this statement. I didn't bring it with me, and it just came to my mind now, so I won't give it to you exactly. But in their rule, the Companions of Emmaus, I remember reading this. He says, we often wonder what we should do, and it looks all very problematic. He said, it's not. It's very simple. He said, the answer to Christian life is, in whatever situation you are, to go to the poorest and help them. He just puts it flat like that, and you think, oh, God, it's too true to believe. Go to the poorest and help them. Start there. Start with the poorest, and then you won't go wrong. So I offer that to you as just a reflection from the prophetic Old Testament word. I believe it's the main point of the book of the Apocalypse, and I think that's obvious from reading what was the key problem of Rome and what our author, critiquing in the light of the prophetic word of the Old Testament, in the light of Jesus' own experience, is saying to these people, don't get caught up in that system, but remain with Christ, remain with each other, remain with the poor, and you have a mission to the whole world, including the Roman Empire. You know, it's a big mission to transform the whole fabric of society according to the values of Jesus. Well, we haven't any lesser mission, have we? Let's leave it at that now, and we'll have lunch.